MacCast, Wednesday, October 25th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, here I am with you on a, for me, it's Wednesday, a very warm, what's going to be a very warm Wednesday. It's been hot here in Southern California. You may or may not be aware, but it's the first time we had to break out the air conditioner this year. So we've had kind of a mild summer, which is good. But anyway, I'm sitting here. It's the morning recording the show and looking over the show notes. And boy, do we have a lot of things to talk about. It should be a fun show. We're just days now, literally days, 2 days away from the pre-sale launch of the iPhone X. So we're going to be talking about that a little bit, of course. Apple has given us some more information about how Siri works, which is kind of interesting. We've got more countries rolling out Apple Pay. We're going to talk about a little bit about where you buy your Apple products. I'm curious about that because some research came out. And the Mac Mini gets a little bit of love, or someone asked about the Mac Mini and Apple gave a response. We'll talk about that a little bit, and also Apple's TV stuff. And then I've got some follow-up for you. We're going to talk a little bit more about the iOS 11 wake issue that I've been having. I got some information from you, clarification on some of the 4K Apple TV stuff that we talked about last week. And an insurance company is giving away Apple Watches. Well, not quite giving away Apple Watches, but I have some questions for you related to that too. And then kind of the big piece of the show is I invited Michael Simmons of Flexibits on the show. You may or may not be aware they have a new application out. We're going to talk to him about that. But more importantly, we're going to talk to him about how they put together and develop apps. It was a very interesting interview. And I would say anybody who's interested in apps, app development, whatever it might be, you're going to really want to stay tuned in for that. It was a great interview. Michael is a super smart person, been around in the industry for a long time. So we talked about, you know, strategies and how pricing works. And if you've ever wondered about that whole process, it's a great interview. So should be a really fun show. I'm just going to jump right into it. And we'll start with Apple Pay rolling out in some more countries this past week. Apple Pay has launched in Denmark, Finland, Sweden, and the United Arab Emirates. Apple Pay is now available in 20 countries. That would be the U.S., Australia, Canada, China, France, Hong Kong, Ireland, Italy, Japan, New Zealand, Russia, Singapore, Spain, Switzerland, Taiwan, and the U.K., in addition to the four new countries. Apple has noted on their developer blog that developers in the new countries can also now use Apple Pay as a secure payment option for in-app purchases and online transactions. And it looks like Apple Pay and Sweden, Finland, let's not combine those two countries, two separate countries, Sweden, Finland, and Denmark, that's going to be currently supported by two banks in each country, and Apple Pay in the UAE is supported by six banks, so more bank support in the UAE, and that's actually kind of a big part of Apple Pay when it rolls out. I believe in Australia, I want to say there's only one bank being represented. New Zealand actually added their second bank this week. Bank of New Zealand has been added as the second bank in that country to support Apple Pay. So that was kind of alongside these other Apple Pay announcements. And when it launched in New Zealand last year, Apple Pay has only been available to ANZ Bank customers. And I think Australia is kind of a similar situation. I've heard from some of you down there and saying, yeah, Apple, Adam, you've been talking about all the problems you have at retail. They don't have that. They have support for NFC at retail in a lot of places, but it's the bank support that they're missing. So, you know, Apple doing their best to roll this out. They have to do negotiations and deals in each country with each bank, with the credit card processors. So I don't envy the amount of effort Apple has to go through to roll this out, but it's kind of a big deal. They're in 20 countries now. And it does sort of meet the promises that Apple's CFO Luca Maestri had promised in the last quarterly earnings conference call back in August. He did say they would add four new countries before the end of the year, and that's exactly what they did. Now, I know There's a lot of you out there who are going, well, it's still not in my country, especially I hear a lot from those of you in Germany. It's a little bit of a sore subject. You know, you'd think that would be a region Apple would have already rolled out to, but possible good news for you, there have been recent rumors that Apple Pay might be coming to your region soon. I say that tentatively because we've heard these rumors before and it hasn't happened. There's also rumors that Poland and the Netherlands may be getting Apple Pay soon. So, you know, hang in there. It'll roll out. Again, there's always challenges in each and every country and they tend to be different. I think, I've been verbal about retailers in this country having mixed support for Apple Pay, and it's getting better. It is getting better. I don't want to be negative about it. As a matter of fact, Albertsons, one of the largest grocery chains here in the United States, did announce that they're bringing Apple Pay support back to all of their various grocery stores, and they own a bunch of different stores throughout the country, Safeway stores and things like that. And I think on a past show, I flopped that. I thought Safeway had owned Albertsons, but it's the other way around. So we'll make that correction now too. And then one other thing related to Apple Pay, MasterCard announced that cardholders will no longer have to provide a signature for Apple Pay purchases in the US and Canada after April 2018. They are changing that requirement, and that change will apply to both debit and credit cards. So that's been another kind of sticking point that I've heard from a lot of you on, is that, you know, why with Apple Pay are we still having to sign or use PINs? I thought the whole point was not having to do that. Well, looks like some of the credit card companies, and I think we talked about this possibly coming a little while back, it looks like now they're moving forward with this change in the requirements, at least MasterCard, and hopefully Visa will follow suit pretty quickly. But that's the latest that we know about what's going on with Apple Pay. There is an Apple blog, and actually calling it a blog is probably not fair. Apple has their Machine Learning Journal website, and that's the place where they're starting to release more information and details about what they're doing in the field of machine learning and artificial intelligence and things like that. A lot of their researchers are going in and releasing papers and information there. And they did an update this week that shared some insights on Siri, and more specifically, how Hey Siri works. And I say that phrase and know that my phone has gone off now, but probably most of yours did not, because Apple has done a lot of work in the area of their speech recognizer. And this article goes into some pretty interesting details. I will link to it in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to get to the real technical stuff. But I wanted to give you a quick overview of what we now know. There's a very small speech recognizer that's running all the time on your phone, and it's listening for that little magic phrase. And when it thinks it has heard that, it then triggers a deep neural network to convert the acoustic patterns of your voice at each instant into this probability distribution over speech sounds. And it uses something called a temporal integration process to compute a confidence score of the phrase that you uttered, and try and decide, was that actually Hey Siri? And if the score is high enough, then Siri wakes up and does its thing. Now, obviously, all this is happening in a matter of probably milli, if not microseconds. It's doing it very quickly and over again. So the technology behind it is sort of amazing. But one interesting bit of information is the piece also mentions that when they are comparing that confidence score, they're actually using kind of a range. They have a normal threshold and then a lower threshold. And if you hit the lower threshold, but not the normal threshold, what happens is that the system will enter a more sensitive state for a few seconds. And that is because you're likely to say the phrase again. And at that point, it's going to be more likely to detect and trigger the Siri to start working, which is a nice kind of little enhancement. And in case you're wondering about, well, what about battery life and all this stuff, basically when it is listening all the time, it's using Apple's always-on processor, which is a small, low-power auxiliary processor that's embedded into the motion coprocessor on your iPhone. So it's doing this all the time, very, very efficiently, And then only when it detects the phrase does it actually wake up the main processor and then do the whole deep neural network processing. So, you know, it sort of ramps things up when it believes and has determined to an accurate level, or what it feels like is an accurate level, that you actually said, "Hey Siri." And on the server, there goes my "Hey Siri" again. On the server, they also will do things to try and figure out, hey, did they really not say that phrase? Did they just say something close like, "Hey, seriously?" And if it hears that, it immediately sends a cancellation request. And actually, my iPhone just did that. It thought I said that magic phrase. And then once it hit the servers, it recognized, nope, that's not what you said. It did deeper processing and it actually canceled "Hey Siri" automatically. So the piece goes into a lot more detail, like I said, of how all of this stuff works. It also covers how they use machine learning along with how they do their acoustic models and their testing to actually fine tune the system. And it's pretty fascinating stuff. So if you didn't catch it this week, again, a link to that will be in the show notes at mattcast.com. But it's always kind of cool to find out about how the secret sauce works a little bit over there at Apple. All right, we've got to talk about iPhone X. Preparing for the drought is what I'm calling this. And I know I sound like some crazy, you know, false prophet signaling the end of days. And really what we're talking about is an iPhone. So this is all not that big of a deal. But I'm bringing it up because all signs are pointing to the fact that if, you know, what your world is going to be is owning and being one of the first to own a new iPhone X, it is going to be a little bit rough this year and rougher than past launches. So just prepare for yourself for that. You know, and I'm doing that myself. I may be disappointed. I may not be able to have an iPhone in hand, an iPhone X in hand, and be able to talk to you about the new features. A lot of people want to know about the screen, the new Face ID is a big new feature, and how does that work, and how well does it work? It's going to be a little bit difficult. As a matter of fact, Ming-Chi Kuo thinks that Apple will have about 2 to 3 million units ready at launch when they start shipping on November 3rd. And just as a point of reference, a lot of our past iPhone launches, the pre-order estimates, so when Apple opens up pre-orders for the weekend, typically, and again, these are just estimates because Apple doesn't release actual numbers, but typically in the past, most people have believed Apple pre-sells about 10 to 12 million iPhones. So they're going to have two ready to ship on November 3rd. And of course, there's about a week, right, before they actually start shipping. So supplies will get built up a little bit, but it is going to be tight. And Ming-Chi Kuo does say that Apple has basically sorted out their component shortage issues, and they should be back on track with production in November. But back on track means, I think, about 10 to 20 million units per month, something like that. So, you know, even by the end of the year, it's looking like Apple's going to be significantly behind. What it's looking like is going to be huge demand. Now, Kuo also thinks that the flexible printed circuit board has been the main component recently that's been holding up iPhone production, and Apple sorted that out. The TrueDepth camera system, I think he believes, was sorted a little while ago. We've been hearing a lot about that piece being the bottleneck, but Bloomberg reported just today, just this morning, that Apple has supposedly eased their QA and testing requirements for the laser dot projector. There's actually two parts to the sensor that does the facial detection. There's the laser dot projector, and then there's the camera. And it was believed that laser dot projector, the thing that projects like 30,000 points of light onto your face, that was causing the holdup. And the piece goes into some details explaining that both the lens and the laser components are extremely fragile, and suppliers were having a hard time. And as a matter of fact, at one point, yields on that component were just about 20%. Apple was only accepting about 20% of that component to actually go into production. And as a matter of fact, Foxconn had to pull back some workers, some assembly workers, slow down production on their end. So, you know, these things have a ripple effect through the chain, and that's what's going on. They also mention in the Bloomberg piece that the component has to be extremely precise in the alignment, that just getting the alignment off by a few microns, which is about a fraction of a hair width, that can cause the component not to work properly. So this is new cutting edge technology, and it's never been done before at this kind of scale. So that's the kind of things that they're struggling with. And Apple has supposedly said, okay, look, on the QA requirements, we're backing off just a little bit. The piece was pretty positive, saying that, you know, the accuracy should still be there. It should still be better than Touch ID. If you remember, during the launch event, Apple said that Touch ID had an accuracy rate of about 1 in 50,000. So, you know, 1 in 50,000 chance of it doing a false positive. With the Face ID technology, they said that was 1 in 1,000,000. That, of course, was with the current the QA standard at the time. By easing that back even just a little bit, the piece says it should still be much more accurate than Touch ID. Not long after this piece came out, though, Apple did something they rarely do. They actually responded to the rumor. This was done via TechCrunch, I believe, and they said that there is no compromise in the accuracy of the Face ID sensor, that what they said during the product announcement, a 1 in 1,000,000 accuracy level, is still the case. They have not changed any of that, and they said that in an official statement through a spokesperson. That doesn't necessarily mean that the Bloomberg piece is wrong in terms of Apple easing the QA requirements on their suppliers. It just means that their interpretation of what that means is not exactly accurate. That, you know, Apple could be accepting some level of lower tolerance on the part, but not compromising in terms of the accuracy. So language becomes very interesting in this sort of thing. Now, all of this said, there are two things coming out of this piece that I personally worry about a little bit. This information about the fragility of the component part. I mean, that's great during assembly that it could get damaged or they're having trouble with it, but this is going into a phone that gets kind of banged around, dropped, and stuff like that. Is it going to break or become a problem out in the wild? I believe Apple designs and accounts for all this stuff, but it sits in the back of your mind when you read a piece like this. And also the lowering of the QA standards on a brand new and unproven in the wild component. Again, I know they do a lot of lab testing. They've been working on this thing supposedly for like 3 years. So I trust Apple in their decision. I think they believe and firmly believe that making this change is going to be fine. It's going to be all right. But the other side of this is, of course, that all eyes, the media, analysts, everybody, everything is going to be on this new phone. You know, they're watching this technology so closely, and everybody's just waiting on pins and needles for Apple to screw up. And it's not just the camera component, right? It's also the new OLED display. And considering, you know, things in the light of what's going on with Google's ongoing issues with the Pixel and the screen on that device. And I know they're different manufacturers, different processes, different standards and stuff like that. But the point still remains, you know, focus on the iPhone X is huge. This is Apple's biggest new radical design in many, many years. And if everything isn't perfect or right, it is going to be a little bit of an issue for Apple. Again, at the end of the day, we're not saving lives here with an iPhone. Sometimes it does, but, you know, that's not the focus here. We are talking about technology, so we have to step back and put everything in perspective. But, you know, Apple needs to get this right. And if that means, you know, not having enough components out there and slowing things down, that may be more important in the long run for them than just, you know, meeting demand. And Apple always, again, does a pretty good job of catching up. I'm sure they have a handle on this, and it's not going to be that big a deal. But at least up front, we do know, you know, shipments are going to be pretty constrained. And, you know, we did get a report, again, going back to putting this in perspective, from Nikkei, suggesting that iPhone X shipments will only reach about 20 million units by the end of the year. This is based on a 10 million unit a month production level, which is something Ming-Chi Kuo had talked about. So that does seem to be where Apple is right now. They can ramp that up pretty quickly. But even Ming-Chi Kuo had originally estimated that Apple would ship about 45 million iPhone X units in 2017. He then revised it down to 40, then to 30 to 35. Now he's at the same point as many others at 25 to 30 million. So that gives us just an indication of what's going on. The other thing related to iPhone that's been happening recently is a lot of people questioning and wondering if iPhone 8 demand is as high as Apple was expecting, or is it, if it's as high as Apple wanted it to be. And the Economic Daily News reported that Apple is planning to cut iPhone 8 and 8 Plus production by nearly 50% in November and December. They're saying that a lot of this is so that their suppliers can focus on production of the iPhone 10, ramping that up. So it may or may not be related to how sales of those devices are doing, but some are speculating that sales of the iPhone 8 are not going well. At least one analyst is suggesting that the iPhone 7 is outselling the iPhone 8 just a month after launch. As far as the revisions in production, you know, that can really be typical. I'm not reading too much into this because Apple ramps things up right before launch, and then as the device launches, they can actually slow down on production to level out with where demand is. So, you know, they have a big buildup in the supply chain, they roll back a little bit, and then they adjust as sales move on throughout the year. So this is a typical sort of thing. And as a matter of fact, UBS did a survey showing that the intent to purchase an iPhone within the next 90 days is actually at its highest levels since Apple launched the iPhone 6. They polled about 3,840 customers in North America, and 69% said they're planning on buying a new iPhone in the next 90 days. And actually 43% of those surveyed said they intended to purchase an iPhone 10. So more than half are going for a different model, probably an iPhone 8, it could be an iPhone 7, 8 Plus, you know, who knows, they didn't really break it down. But their survey did show that the iPhone 8 Plus does seem to be a little bit more popular than the iPhone 8. And Bernstein also did their own survey of about 1,000 iPhone owners across the US, UK, and China, and they found that 48% were, quote, excited about the iPhone 10, and of those, about 25% said they intended to buy an iPhone 10. So iPhone 10 sales, I think, are going to be huge. I'm not too worried about Apple's quarterly numbers for their next call. I think iPhone, both in the 8 and the 10, is going to do very, very well. Because we are just days away, you've probably going to hear this episode right before you need to pre-order your iPhone. A big question I've been being asked by you is, what are the things we need to do to make sure that we have our best possible chance of securing an iPhone 10 on launch day? And I talked about this a little bit in the last episode, so I want to go into a little more detail this time around. And let me just caveat this by saying, you know, I'm not an expert in this stuff. I have ordered iPhones at every launch a number of times. These are the things that I'm going to be doing. They're what I feel are the best chances. There's a lot of articles out there that suggest different things, but this is what's worked for me. It may or may not work for you. So this is not a guarantee. I want to say that right up front. This is not a guarantee that you're going to get your iPhone 10 pre-order in before anyone else, or that you're going to get earlier than anyone else. But they are some things that I think you can do that will increase your chances. One thing you definitely want to do is prepare for your pre-order. Pre-orders are going to happen on Friday, October 27th at 12:01 a.m. Pacific time. So yes, for many people, that means Thursday night, right? Stay up late Thursday night and right first thing Friday, 12:01 a.m., get your order in. Be prepared to get your order in. If you are in the Apple Upgrade Program, that's the program that Apple has where you can upgrade every year. Right now, you can go on the Apple Store app and get pre-approved for your upgrade. This is different than in past years. Last year, you had to go into an Apple retail store. Now you can do it in the app because you need to pass a credit check and make sure that you're qualified and all that sort of stuff. Get it done now. Do not wait until right before midnight on launch day when everybody else is trying to do it. So go in there. Make sure you're pre-approved if you're part of that program. Next thing you're going to want to do to get pre-prepared is make sure that your payment method, your shipping address, all other account data on your iTunes account, on your Apple Store account are up to date and ready to go. This includes making sure that the credit card on file is the correct one with the correct billing address, that your expiration date is up to date and accurate, and that you have your authentication code, that CVV2 code, in there accurately. I actually hit a hiccup last year where some things had changed with my card and this caused me a problem at checkout. I was going to use Apple Pay, didn't work. I had to go back. I had to figure it all out. And that was a huge delay in the ordering process. So again, get this done and checked up front. Go into the App Store app, go into your account on apple.com in the store section and make sure it's all accurate. Another thing I would really advise, if you use Apple Pay, turn it on, make sure that it's working. Maybe even do a sort of pre-order, pre-check order, you know, order an accessory or a cable, something that you've been meaning to buy anyway, through the App Store app a day or so before you're actually going to order your iPhone. Just make sure everything is working smoothly. And also, make sure you have your credit cards ready on the actual night and standing by just in case there is a problem and you need to grab a credit card and enter the data into the checkout process. You know, have it ready to go. Backup. So everything I'm going to tell you is about making sure you have another way. If something goes wrong, be prepared for something going wrong. Hopefully it'll go completely smoothly and you won't have any issues, but be prepared. And then make sure you go into the Apple Store app and now and pre-configure your device and save it as a favorite. And I guess I should have started this whole process off with the fact that I believe that using the Apple Store app on your iOS device is the best way to go. It's proven out the quickest, fastest, best way to go over the past few years. Again, as a backup, have your browser open to Apple's website, have that ready to go and check. And I even sometimes alternate when, you know, right before pre-order, when I'm trying to get in and see if the store is opened up, because what Apple does is pulls the store down and then they open it up at some point. And it's not always right at 12:01 a.m. Sometimes it can be 10 minutes later. The App Store app seems to open up before the online store. Can I guarantee you that's going to happen this year? No, but that's the way it's been in the past. So use the Apple Store app. But in the Apple Store app, you can go in and pre-configure, and you might also be able to do this online, but you can select all the options for your device, right? So you can say, I want the black one, I want the 256 gigabyte model on AT&T, and you can add it as a favorite. There's a little heart in there. Click it as a favorite and have some backup configurations ready to go. So put your first choice in there, favorite your second choice, maybe even a third choice if you want, if you're willing to compromise on some of those options to get your phone sooner, then have those ready to go in your favorites. And then when the time hits, make sure you have the app open. You may need to keep opening it to get it to refresh. And when the store actually goes live, you're going to go into your account area. You should see your favorites right there. Tap the favorite one that is ready to go. Verify that it's correct. That's the other thing. Make sure you order the correct one. Tap a buy. Hopefully you hit Apple Pay at that point. And then pray that it all works and goes smoothly. And again, be prepared to back up and have to do it all over again if some sort of weird thing happens or failure. Now, again, this is the whole process if you're ordering from Apple. If you're going through your carrier, I don't have experience with that. It varies from carrier to carrier. So do some research on that up front and check now. And for everybody, good luck. I hope it goes smoothly. I hope everybody who wants an iPhone X gets one in the early ordering. I will be up there with everybody. And it's just going to be a crapshoot on the whole thing. So it should be fun. If you want to follow me online, I'll be on Twitter, I'm sure, tweeting things along with the rest of the entire Apple community. And last thing, I guess, to comment on this is if you do want to get one at the Apple Store, if you want to go to an Apple retail store on November 3rd, which is the actual launch day when they start shipping them and pick them up, apparently Apple says you're going to be able to do that too. If you get there really early, and I will say you are really lucky, because again, Apple is saying they are going to have quote unquote limited inventory of the iPhone X available for walk-in customers on November 3rd. Who knows about colors, configurations, all those sorts of things. They are encouraging customers to arrive early. I kind of have a feeling that Apple is going to have a McDonald's Szechuan sauce moment happening at Apple retail stores with customers coming in. I could be completely wrong, and I hope that I am. But I would not bank on being able to walk into an Apple retail store and pick one up. I would pre-order it if you really want to get your hands on one. I guess as a backup, if your pre-order, something happens, it doesn't go well, you might be able to camp out at an Apple retail store overnight before November 3rd and maybe, just maybe, get your hands on an iPhone 10. But for a lot of us, it could mean not getting an iPhone 10 this year. It might be 2018. And that, again, is not the end of the world. It's going to be disappointing. I'm not going to say it won't be disappointing if that happens, but it may be the case. And just, you know, prepare yourself mentally for that scenario to happen. And, you know, we'll be all right. Everyone will get their iPhone 10 in time. And I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be a great device. I'm really excited to try out the new technologies. And again, I hope it all goes smoothly. But that's kind of the latest on what we can expect for launch day in just a couple days. So here's an interesting question. Where do you buy your Apple products? Consumer Intelligence Research Partners did a survey of about 2,000 U.S. consumers and asked them that exact question, consumers who bought Apple products last year. And the results surprised me a little bit. It might surprise you, too. What they found was that about 40% of Macs were purchased directly from Apple. And that number was actually a little bit higher than I would have thought. But then I stepped back and considered, well, you know, a lot of people want to do a build to order configuration. And if you want to do that, you sort of have to order from Apple. You can't really get build to order configurations outside of Apple's own system, their retail stores or their online sales. So, yeah, that does make a little bit of sense. They also found that 75% of iPhones were purchased directly from carriers. Again, maybe not so surprising because you're going on a contract and you already are working with your carrier. I personally have always purchased from Apple directly, but those of us who do that apparently are in the minority. About 10%, according to their survey, purchased directly from Apple. The other surprising thing was iPads. More people buy iPads from Best Buy, one of Apple's third-party resale partners, than they do from Apple, though not by much. They said 25% of folks bought iPads through Best Buy, 20% bought through an Apple store, and the rest through other channels. Now, the piece does note that seasonally, around product launches and things like that, direct sales make up a much higher percentage for brief periods. But overall, that's sort of where it plays out. So, again, I don't think huge surprising things in here, a little bit of stuff that I wasn't expecting, but I will ask you, where do you buy your Apple products? Where do you typically buy them? Are you going to a Best Buy or a Target? Are you going directly to Apple? Or are you using some other sort of online source, maybe Amazon, those sorts of things? I'd be curious to know. If you want to send me some feedback, you can shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. I am a pretty big fan of Apple's Mac Mini. I actually have two Mac Minis in my house. One is a Mac Mini from 2006, and yes, it is still in daily use as a backup server. My wife has a 2014 Mac Mini, and they're great, but I mean, let's face it, the last update, the 2014 one, it happened 3 years ago, and it wasn't a stellar update. It wasn't, you know, breaking any records. And as a matter of fact, it has a little bit of a slow hard drive in it. So it suffers from some performance issues unless you upgrade it to an SSD. But, you know, it's a great model. It's something that I think is important to Apple's lineup. But of course, a lot of us who are Mac Mini fans, we wonder, you know, does Apple still think it's important? Everything else in the Apple's lineup has received a relatively recent update. So a lot of Mini fans are wondering, hey, what about the Mini? Are you guys going to do something with it? Well, a Mac Rumors reader actually decided to go straight to the highest source at Apple. He emailed Tim Cook himself and said, hey, when are we going to get a Mac Mini update? Essentially, I'm really paraphrasing there. And of course, Tim Cook didn't reveal much, but he did reiterate what he basically said to tech journalists way back when they had that secret Mac Pro meeting. You remember that? Apple invited about five members of the media in for a little private chat about their plans for the Pro, and that's when they sort of revealed they were going to do an iMac Pro and they were going to do a Mac Pro in 2018. During that same event, they had said, hey, the Mac Mini is still important to us. And basically, he reiterated that stuff. He says, you know, there's a lot of customers out there who love the Mac Mini. They use it in very creative and interesting ways. And we at Apple, we love it also. He said it's going to be a, quote, important part of the lineup going forward. Of course, he also said in typical Apple fashion, it's not time to share any details. So he's not giving up any information about when that love would be bestowed upon the Mac Mini and Mac Mini fans. But the good news is that Apple still considers it an important part of the lineup. Typically, I think before the 2014 update, it had been about 3 years. So I'm expecting 2018 sometime we'll hear some news about the Mac Mini. So if you're a Mac Mini fan, stay tuned for that. But if you're expecting another keynote from Apple, another little event before the end of the year, that's likely not going to happen. Another person had emailed Craig Federighi asking about, you know, are we going to get an October event? And he basically replied saying Apple is, quote unquote, keynoted out for the season. So don't expect any more updates this year. The lineup that we've heard about is pretty much the lineup of new products that are going to be coming. And there's actually, you know, some significant things. The iMac Pro is getting ready to go. We're hearing reports that they're preparing the AMD Radeon Pro Vega cards for that. Apple has said it will be available in December, so that's coming. We also have the HomePod, which should be available in December, and of course, the iPhone X launch here in just a couple days. So still some big things before the end of the year from Apple, but that's about it. Anything else is going to be happening in 2018. And then finally in the news for this week, some news around Apple's original TV content effort. Apple has added another television executive to their growing team. Variety has reported that Morgan Wendell, head of international series at Amazon Studios, currently has been hired by Apple to develop original content for their international audiences. Morgan Wendell had been working on many successful projects over there at Amazon Studios. He did Sneaky Pete, Man in a High Castle, and Goliath. He's expected to begin working for Apple by the end of this month, so pretty much as you're hearing this. And he's joining a number of other studio executives that Apple has been poaching from in and around Hollywood recently to build out this original video content team, which is headed up by two former Sony executives, Jeremy Ehrlich and Zach Van Amberg. And these are, you know, pretty big heavy players in the entertainment industry. And if you remember last week, it was announced that Apple signed on the reboot of the Steven Spielberg series from the 80s, Amazing Stories. I'm super excited about that. I'm actually going in and watching the original series, and I had forgotten how much star power that series had in the 80s. You know, all your favorite stars from the 80s are in those episodes, and they're available for free, at least to people in the U.S. I don't know outside the U.S., in the NBC app. So you can go into the NBC app and you can watch. They had two seasons of it in the mid-80s, and it's really great. So go back and watch that if you want to get a sense for what that is. But the new series should be awesome, too, because Apple really has committed some resources to it. They've agreed to create 10 episodes with a production budget of $5 million per episode. And the original series did have pretty high production values. Not great, you know, it's not movie level, but it's pretty darn good. And Apple is reportedly looking to spend about $1 billion on creating new original programming over the next year. So they're pretty serious about it. They're supposedly looking around and adding office space and studio space in and around Culver City, California to support these efforts. And we can fully expect these kinds of big announcements around content to continue, because supposedly they're looking around for a, quote, Game of Thrones level drama series. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what they come up with. And actually, there's some great stuff going up on Apple Music, especially around the documentary area. They've released a number of music documentaries recently, and I've caught a few of them, and it's great stuff. And I'm finding them actually through the TV app now, and it's making some great recommendations. So I love the new TV app, and I think, again, this is the area where it's going to grow when they start adding in this new content. The question becomes, is it going to be a new service or is it going to be something that's rolled into Apple Music? And we just don't know at this point. I'm hoping they roll it into the Apple Music service and continue to grow that by adding new great video content. They may have to do some rebranding at some point and rename it, but I'm looking forward to seeing what they come up with. And we've been getting some great news around this over the past couple of weeks. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you about Smile's PDF pen applications for Mac, for iOS, the whole entire lineup, actually. And, you know, I love them. When I need to scan or manipulate or edit or work with PDFs in any way, I use PDF Pen from Smile. It's just the way I do it. And the reason why is I like the fact that it allows me to do everything I need to do with PDF, like add signatures, fill out what I call fake forms. Those are PDF forms that aren't real forms, right? They don't have real form fields. So you need to be able to add text into those. And you can do that with PDF Pen with ease. It allows me to edit and redact text, all from a great user interface. And really the best part of it, and why I like PDF Pen so much, is it's one set of tools that I can use across all my platforms and devices. So it doesn't matter if on my Mac or my iPhone or my iPad, I can use all of it. On the Mac, of course, you've got PDF Pen for Mac OS. It's really the ultimate PDF editing tool. It's kind of like a Swiss Army knife for PDFs. On my iPhone, if I need to get a document in there, there's PDF Pen Scan Plus. It gives me scanning and OCR capabilities. It integrates with all of their other applications, and I can scan a document or a receipt real quickly, save it for later, bring it into PDF Pen for editing on my iPad, on my Mac. Doesn't really matter. And of course, then you have PDF Pen 3, the new updated application for iPad and iPhone. And the big part of the upgrade is it integrates the PDF tools with iOS 11's new features, specifically the new files infrastructure and the files application. That makes it now really easy to integrate and find all of my PDF documents wherever they are, whatever my favorite storage mechanism is, whether I use iCloud, Dropbox, Google Drive, Transmit. Doesn't matter where it went into. And I use all of these things because I have projects that are going on with people in Dropbox. I put my own stuff pretty much into iCloud, and I have things on Google Drive. And now I can get at all of those PDFs on my iPhone or iPad very easily and work with them in PDF Pen. So if you want to see all the great new features of PDF Pen 3 for iOS and check out PDF Pen for Mac and PDF Pen Scan Plus, you can do it all by going to smilesoftware.com/podcast. And that's a new URL. So go to smilesoftware.com/podcast. Check out all of the great software there. And a big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the show. So I want to follow up a little bit on my iOS 11, what I'm calling a wake from sleep issue. I don't know if that's probably the right term, but basically I've been having this problem, and I've talked about it and asked you if you were having the same issues, where I put my iPhone to sleep using the sleep wake button, or it goes to sleep naturally, and I'll go to try and turn it back on using the sleep wake button or pressing the home button, and nothing happens. The screen basically stays blank and it feels like it's gone dead. But I know it's not dead because the home button is still clicking. It's still working. So I wait 20 or 30 seconds. Sometimes the screen will flicker or flash or kind of fade up and fade down. It's a really weird bug. And I said, am I the only one having this? Do I have a hardware problem on my phone? Is it something with the sleep wake button? But many of you have confirmed that you've been seeing this bug as well. I've also had many people say, no, I'm not having any issues. So I don't know what the combination of factors are. And I did try doing a full backup and restore of my device. I've pretty much troubleshooted it in every way that you could possibly troubleshoot an iOS device, all the way going to doing a full backup and restore. And even after doing that, the issues persisted. So I'm pretty convinced this is some sort of software bug. Now, one listener did write in and mention that he used Xcode and the logging and debugging tools to find an app that seemed to be crashing in the background when the phone was asleep. And that was causing, in his case, he felt, the phone to not wake up properly. And he said that reinstalling that one app, basically deleting it from his device and reinstalling it, solved his wake issues. But for me, you know, doing an erase and install of iOS, as you know now, actually reinstalls all your apps from scratch, right? Because it puts the operating system back on. It puts all your preferences and everything back on, but apps are re-downloaded from the App Store and reinstalled. So that fix may be unrelated, but I'm bringing it up because one listener said it did work for him. So if you have access to the Xcode tools, it might be something worth trying. There's another issue that I've been having with my phone that I want to bring up, which is Bluetooth disconnecting issues. And I bring this up because, again, another few listeners have emailed me and said, hey, have you been experiencing this where you'll be driving connected to a Bluetooth device or Bluetooth headset, and suddenly everything just disconnects. And I have been getting that. What's weird for me is it's usually at the same place when I'm leaving my house. So I put my iPhone into my car. It connects to an Anker Bluetooth device that I have plugged into my stereo. And that's always worked great. But after upgrading to iOS 11, I'll have it where it'll just drop out. The podcast I'm listening to or the music that I'm listening to will suddenly stop. The whole thing will drop. It will disconnect. And then it will reconnect. And I thought, well, that's kind of weird, too. And it's been getting progressively, I think, a little bit worse. And I don't know why that's happening. But I bring this up a little bit because now I have a theory that maybe both these things are related. And what I think may be happening, and I'm asking you, for those of you who are experiencing these kinds of problems, do you have Do Not Disturb while driving turned on? Because I've enabled that feature and I absolutely love it. But I'm having this theory that now that since that's the one variable, it's kind of a new feature. It's related to Bluetooth. It's also related to waking up the screen, right? Because the screen doesn't wake up when you have Do Not Disturb while driving enabled. I'm wondering if that's the thing that's causing the issue. So I just yesterday disabled that on my phone, and I will report back. But so far, I have not noticed the wake from sleep issue. I haven't been out driving yet, so I will see if that fixes the driving Bluetooth issue. And if it does, I'll report back. But you might try this as well. Let's just see if that's a variable. So I'm bringing that up for that reason. One other quick iPhone iOS 11 bug to let you know about, and this is a really weird one, and I'm surprised I haven't caught this yet. Well, maybe not so surprised, but apparently there is an iOS 11 calculator bug. Apple redesigned the calculator, and they added these new animations to the buttons, specifically when you type an operations button, so like plus, minus, divide, multiply. There's this kind of fade animation that happens. Apparently, that's slowing down and stopping it from detecting the next button push. So if you're trying to add something quickly, say three numbers, what happens is you hit one plus two plus, and then when you hit three, what you end up doing is rather than adding the two numbers, it actually types 23. So you end up with the result of 24. And this happens no matter what operator you use. So it's a pretty quirky bug. Apple is definitely aware of it. It's existed since the betas. Apple has over 70 radars filed. That's Apple's bug reporting system for developers. So let's hope it gets fixed in the next release. But I'm surprised none of you had mentioned that to me. It had gone unnoticed by me, at least. So I'm bringing it up in case you're trying to use the calculator and wondering why am I getting weird, not correct results. I personally use CalcBot, which is a great third-party calculator app, so I hadn't really noticed this. But a few little bugs just to know about with iOS 11, and it's looking like iOS 11 0.1 is going through several beta updates. It's been pushed out to developers, I think, three or four times now. So hopefully that's going to have a lot of big bug fixes in it. We've already got up to 11.0.3, but that's all been minor things so far. So we'll see if Apple addresses some of these issues. A little bit of follow-up on my Apple TV 4K interview with Ara Derderian, and specifically talking about what people are calling the forced 4K of the Apple TV. We talked about the fact that Apple TV, during the setup, what happens is that with the Apple TV 4K, you're going to pick, or the TV is going to recommend a setting to you, a format setting, based on the output capabilities of your TV. So if your TV supports, say, the Dolby Vision and 60 hertz and 4K, it will recommend, hey, set your Apple TV settings to 4K Dolby Vision 60 hertz. Or if it's Dolby 10 or Vision 10 or Dolby 10, I can't remember what the other standard is. Whatever the standards are, whatever your TV supports, whether it supports HDR or SDR, it will recommend that setting. And then once you set that, what happens is that the Apple TV will only send that formatted signal to your TV. So your TV always believes that the signal that it's getting is whatever it's set to in the Apple TV, regardless of what format the source is in. And this is a problem for especially video enthusiasts. So say you had an input signal, some content coming in that was actually 24 frames per second, standard definition content. What'll happen is the Apple TV will convert that. It will upscale, upconvert, add information, where it's getting that information from. I think that's some of the concern of video enthusiasts. But basically, it'll do that, and it will output it to the settings that were set up in the Apple TV. So again, if that's 4K Dolby Vision at 60 hertz, your 24 frame per second content becomes 60 frame per second content. It gets upscaled and upconverted, and also the SDR gets moved into an HDR space, and your TV happily thinks, oh, I'm getting, you know, 4K Dolby Vision 60 hertz content, when that might not be the original content, and that can have variable results on the picture quality and what's going on. And so some video enthusiasts might not like that. And I don't think we made this super clear when I was doing the interview with Ara, so I wanted to bring that up. Now, you can manually change the output of your Apple TV at any time by going into the settings to match the input, but that's kind of a pain in the butt, and you may not always know the video source coming in. And because the Apple TV is reporting something different to your television set, even pressing the info button on your TV may not be telling you exactly what's coming in. And it isn't if you're connected to an Apple TV. So a lot of people are saying it would be nice to have a setting in there that says, hey, if you have source content coming in that doesn't match my current settings, adjust my current settings automatically to match that. Don't make me go in manually and adjust that. And so, again, I'm bringing this up because it might be confusing to some people. A really good example of where it could be confusing is, say, you have content on the Apple TV that doesn't support 4K, specifically YouTube videos. Those don't support 4K, even though in the YouTube app it might be labeled as 4K HDR. What actually gets sent to the Apple TV is an HD signal in standard dynamic range, and the Apple TV will then take that, upscale, upconvert it to 4K HDR and deliver that to your TV, and your TV is going to say, oh, I'm getting 4K HDR, which matches what the YouTube app is saying. And so a lot of people might think that they're watching true 4K HDR content in the original format that it was uploaded to YouTube in. They're not, and that's where it could be confusing for some people. What does this mean at the end of the day? For most people, they're probably not going to notice or care. And this is what Apple does, right? They set it up so that you have a set it and forget it kind of thing. You set it up during the setup process, and everything coming into your app, into your TV, is going to be what your TV supports. And that's going to be okay for a lot of people. But still, for those of you who do care, this is good information to know about. And I want to thank Diego for emailing in and asking me to clarify these points and pointing me to some really helpful articles in figuring this out. So hopefully that clears up any confusion that may have resulted from my interview with Ara. So if your life insurance company offered you an Apple Watch for $25, would you take them up on that offer? Don't answer that till I get to the end of the segment. So the life insurance firm John Hancock, they're going to offer their customers a 38 millimeter GPS Apple Watch via their Vitality program. And if you take advantage of it, if you're one of their customers, this is in the U.S., it's going to be $25 U.S. to get that Apple Watch. Of course, it comes with a little bit of a catch. You have to meet a fitness goal set by their Vitality program. So you have to earn 500 fitness-based Vitality points each month. Otherwise, you're going to have to pay back the Apple Watch cost in installments, I would assume, billed through your insurance premium. If you want a different model, not just the 38 millimeter GPS, if you want a different finish, a different band, an LTE model, you can pay the cost difference. So basically you get like a $304 credit, right, to buy an Apple Watch if you're a John Hancock customer in their Vitality program. And it sounds pretty cool. I mean, the idea for them is that if you stay healthier, they're going to have to pay out less on your medical insurance, your medical care claims. And so that's good for them. But I also bet that they really like the idea of getting all that juicy customer behavior and fitness data, right? They can aggregate that, they can use that. But the bigger concern is, are they going to use that if you're not being healthy to adjust the amount that you're going to have to pay for your life insurance premiums. If they don't think you're being as healthy as they think you should be, you know, they're basically, you're letting them monitor your data and your lifestyle. And I have just a little bit of a concern about that, you know? So this sounds good up front. Yeah, I get a $25 Apple Watch. That is awesome. But there are some caveats and I think some things to think about. So I'm a little bit cautious about this sort of thing. I think we're going to see it from more health insurance providers. So I'm going to ask you, would you sell or give up your data, and allow your insurance company, your health insurance company, to monitor your health and lifestyle data in exchange for paying less or for getting a free or a very cheap or inexpensive Apple Watch? I'm not so sure that I would. So curious to hear your thoughts. Shoot me some emails, some audio comments, maccast@gmail.com. All right, last thing to get into in this episode is my interview with Michael Simmons. He is from FlexiBits. FlexiBits, you may know from Fantastical, a great calendar app for iPhone and Mac. It's actually the calendar app that I use. I do not use Apple's calendar app on iOS or my Mac. I use Fantastical. It has this great natural language parser. It makes it very quick and easy to put in my calendar events and manage to-dos and things like that. I absolutely love it. Now FlexiBits has gone to try and do the same thing for our contacts, and they've created this great menu bar application called CardHop. I absolutely love it. I've started using it, and it's immediately integrated itself into my daily life. Michael's going to talk about how it works and what makes it so awesome in this interview, so I'm not going to spoil it for you now. But more importantly, I invited Michael in to talk about how they come up with their ideas for apps, how they take those ideas and turn them into successful applications. They've been very successful at launching their applications. They make really great, high-quality applications. And I wanted to know, how do you do that? What is the magic secret sauce? So if you've ever wondered about what goes on behind the scenes in app development, this is a great interview. So here's my conversation with Michael Simmons from FlexiBits. Hey, Michael, how you doing?
I'm great, Adam. How are you?
I'm doing good. It's been a few years since we've had you over here, but you've been busy.
It has, and yes, I have.
People might not realize it because, you know, you got Fantastical and I'm sure other things going on, but you have a new product and we're going to get into talking about that. Actually, an amazing new product if I, you know, kind of give away a little bit of the ending here, but we'll dive into that. And I guess we can tell people what it is, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You want to tell them what the new app is?
Yeah. So of course, you know, Fantastical well, and in the spirit of calendars and productivity problems, we released CardHop on Wednesday. CardHop is a contacts app that, again, in the spirit of Fantastical, it uses our natural language parser. So you can easily type things like Adam Christensen or whatever. And with one field, it lets you add, edit, search, and interact with your contacts with no special syntax. So if you type call Adam, it'll start a phone call, or email Adam with a subject, it'll do that. Right. And if I type Adam, obviously it'll find you. That's the search. If I type Adam Christensen and you're not there, then it knows I want to add a new contact. And yeah, everything just kind of works very easily compared to the existing ways of doing contacts, which, as you know, were just boring databases.
Right. Yeah. Going into the contacts app. So we'll get more into, I wanted to give people that context because we're going to be talking about what I want to talk to you about is sort of how you guys come up with your ideas, how you figure out how to collaborate and work together and stuff like that. Because I know a lot of people in my community, at least, are either already maybe struggling developers, or they have an idea or a concept and they're thinking about this as a business that they might want to go into, or they might want to try something, or, you know, it comes up all the time. Hey, I have this great idea for an app. How do I get started? And I think it's a real challenge for people. So I know it's been a few years. We talked about this, I think, a long time ago. But just this time around, I think what I want to get into is you have an app, right? You develop an app. It's hugely successful. Fantastical is, you know, just one of those apps that I think a lot of aspiring developers can look at and go, yeah, that's the kind of quality of an app that I want to make and build. So I think the place to start is, like, you have this big successful app. Obviously, you're supporting it. You're having to deal with that. But you have other ideas, right? And now, how do you, what's the process that you went through? And maybe there's, I don't know, to figure out what the next thing you were going to do was going to be.
Well, believe it or not, CardHop was my idea that came right after Fantastical. Uh-huh. When we started Flexibits, me and my business partner, Kent Sutherland, he's the code meister and magician. And, you know, I do the design and the product ideas. Uh-huh. Of course, he throws in, but, you know, at the end of the day, I'm the director of the products. He had this parsing engine like back in 2008 or nine, and he was kind of like, what should we do with it? So calendars was the first thing. But believe it or not, right when we shipped Fantastical 1 in 2011, the idea for a contacts app came in my head because – again, I kind of want to solve problems that are problems for me. And I know we're talking about how people might want to make the same apps or what they do. So, you right. know, lesson one is solve a problem that's a problem for you.
I think that's great advice. Yeah.
Thanks. And yeah, so after Fantastical shipped, which of course was a lot of work into that, I immediately had this idea and I started sketching and coming up with how we would do it. And the rest is kind of now history. But what's interesting is, yeah, that app idea for CardHop had been in my head, if you will, or at least out of my head around 2011-12. So it's almost 5 years plus in development, that app. Now, we didn't work full time on it 5 years. I want to make that clear. But it definitely was an ongoing, call it project, for the last 5+ years.
So, I mean, when you have something like that, that's that long in... let's not call it development, but it's that long in sort of the thought process, right? So what does that look like? Like, you have the spark of an idea, but like, how are you getting that out? You know, is it are you creating a series of documents? Like, what's the process that you go through over that period of time? So, you know, you write the initial idea, maybe it's just this thought and it's a napkin sketch. How do you go from that to, yeah, we're actually going to start really working on this thing and building it out?
Good question. So the first thing, of course, I have the idea and I think about, oh, yeah, there's a problem that I can solve, whatever. Because in this case, of course, we're making productivity apps. So if you're making a game or you're making a design tool or whatever you're making, a music app, there's different approaches, I think, right? Because productivity, sure, I think, is the most challenging thing to do, because not only do you have to build an app and a user interface and an experience, you have to solve a problem, right? So maybe that's why I like productivity apps also, is because I feel like there's a real benefit when you have a productivity app. I mean, sure, games have entertaining value and music apps have music and entertainment and also learning value. But for me, there's something really nice about a productivity app that does a good job, because it really does make your life better. It truly can save you time and truly can save you frustration. So to get back on track of the question, there's a lot, because you have to first figure out, like, what's the problem? Okay, well, you know, adding to calendars or making new contacts is difficult. But it's not just like, how do you solve it? It's sort of like, okay, what would this look like? So the first step after the idea is, I think about how I would want the app to look. Is it going to be a full app, like a windowed app? Is it going to be a menu bar app, like Fantastical was? And for me, I realized contacts isn't something that I want to spend a lot of time in. In fact, I want to spend as little time as possible, right?
Right.
So for me, it was back to the menu bar idea, because menu bar apps are brilliant in that they're fast. You have a hotkey that you define, you open it up quick, you're in and you're out, and you can open it up from any other app without really switching that context, right?
Sure.
So once I knew it would be a menu bar app, then I thought about how to change it from a idea that we currently have. So contacts apps currently, as I said, they're just databases. If you actually look at the whole segment of contacts apps, they're really big lists and you kind of manage them. It's almost like mail, right? It's like you're managing these big, big behemoths of data. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to move away from that. I wanted to move towards, with this parsing engine that we had, something that would be more intuitive and something that you would on demand call up what you want in that moment. And I think that's why we use computers, right? We want computers to do the work.
Sure.
So yeah, so then we start talking about ideas. Okay, what if it did this? What if it did that? We do napkin sketches. We do actual sketches in pixels, rough wireframes. And off we go. You know, for me anyway, once I have an idea that's a good one, it's easy, really easy for me to just keep adding on to it, because if you're solving a problem that's a genuine problem, and actually I'll give this as lesson two, I think if you're solving something that really is a problem, there's lots of solutions, right? Because the problem exists. If something, if you come up with an idea and you can't really come up with any good ideas to make your app good, maybe it's something that's already been solved and therefore you're just copying what's already out there, or there's just not a good solution.
Right. So are there physical tools or software or things that you're using in this process? Like, do you start with lists? Are you starting with mind maps? Are you starting with outlines and then moving to sketches? Or are you going right into sort of wireframes and sketches? Or, you know, like what tools are you using to actually get those ideas out? So you have all these ideas, right? But I'm assuming you're collecting them and organizing them and evaluating them in some way.
Yeah, definitely. So the initial thing we do is I actually have kind of a philosophy. I don't like to look at other apps. Now, obviously, if I've used Contacts or another Contacts apps that are out there, of course, I've used them, right? But I don't ever personally want to go out and be like, let me go and get as much information from every other app out there. The reason why I don't want to do that is if I'm already at this point where I consider myself a good enough user, a savvy enough user, then I probably haven't found the solution. And for me to go in and specifically look at competition, I think biases a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think, as another tip, you should really design the app you want, not look at what the other apps don't do and fill in that gap. Because then I think you're faking it, right? You're trying to almost, you know, create something just for the sake of, you know, creating it.
Sure. Yeah. You're trying to solve someone else's inefficiencies rather than sort of building your own thing, right?
Bingo. So in terms of tools, you know, step one is, you know, I wouldn't say go out and check out all the competition. I would say you should know the competition by now if you're looking to solve a problem, right? Otherwise, let's be honest, you're just really making an app for profit. And that's another really big tip. I'll actually give that as tip number three, is don't build your app looking to be successful. I've never in my career, and I know I've been very successful and I appreciate my success, but I've never sat down and said, how do I make this, you know, this blockbuster? Never. I've never said, how can we profit? I've never, when we started Flexibits, it was never like, how do we make a lot of money or whatever? It was, hey, let's make apps that are really good. And I think sitting down, and again, what you just said, trying to fill deficiencies or make an app for profit, I think you're not going to make a good app. I think you're going to make an app that you think would be profitable, and maybe it will be, but it's not going to necessarily be a great app.
Right.
Right. It's almost like when companies get successful, they say they never have the same starvation for, or hunger for success, right? Because now they have all this money. They don't have that drive.
Right.
So back to the tools.
Right.
So don't look at competition. That's part one. And then for the tools, what we do is we do sketch on paper, just regular, you know, pencil and paper. But once we get to the point that we really want to get going, I actually work with a great designer artist whose name is Wolfgang Bartelme. He's awesome. He's done a few apps and he has his own independent design studio. He's just a great guy and we work very well together. And what we do is we start with these digital wireframes. We just start sketching stuff out and we use two tools. We use Sketch, which is an amazing design tool. And we also use something called, well, at least I use Acorn, which is another design tool. And yeah, Acorn's a great app. Another indie developer, Gus Mueller, Flying Meat Software.
I love Acorn.
Yeah, really great app. And the thing is I love Sketch. I mean, so here's the way I look at it. Sketch is kind of like my truck and my workhorse that's really beautiful and really efficient. Acorn's almost like a motorcycle or a jet ski where I kind of do more rough work. I do my quick and dirty work in Acorn, but then we do the real final production layout, management, nitty-gritty, actual elements in Sketch.
So how do you... So that's kind of more like on the, hey, I'm thinking through, I'm assuming this is more on the, I'm thinking through how these interactions are going to work, how the thing's going to look and stuff like that. What do you use for just like managing features and like distilling out and trying to figure out, okay, you know, because I'm assuming you start with like the moon and you're adding stuff all the time, right? But at a certain point, you have to have a way to filter that stuff as well. Because I'm assuming you have a lot of features that either don't make the cut or get pushed to like Absolutely. The next thing. So like, how are you managing those things?
So what we do is first we think about, in a way, I'm sure you've heard this term, minimum viable product, right?
Right.
And we think about, okay, what do we need to have in here to at least make ourselves happy that we could use this? Well, in the initial design, as I said, I immediately, when we had the parser, the initial design that came out of my head, I knew that the parser could do this magical search, add, edit, and interact with one field, because we'd been doing Fantastic Hal, and I knew the limitations of the parser. In other words, I know what it can and can't do. Mm-hmm. And I kind of learned those contexts. So the first thing was at least searching, adding, editing, and interacting had to be part of 1.0. Then we started to look at the Apple Contacts app. And I said, you know, not to look at competition, but the Apple Contacts app is part of the OS. So you have to at least know the baseline, right?
Well, and yeah, you're going to have to deeply integrate and interact with that for this
exactly.
product. So you kind of can't avoid
it. Exactly. It's just, it's part of the OS as we see it, you know?
Right.
So we looked at what that had in terms of groups and other stuff. I will tell you, you know, obviously some features did get cut from 1.0. Smart groups, just to put it out there, that was one feature that we wanted in there, but we decided, you know what? We could ship a 1.0 and smart groups can come later. Why does that, like, yes, it's very nice. And yes, it absolutely is handy. And also we have a really cool way that we're solving it. But you know, if you ship a 1.0, are people really not going to use it because it has smart groups? Probably not, right? So we started to make this list as we were designing of what could probably stay in. And some things, quite frankly, got cut at the last minute where, let's say, you know, we're 3 to 6 months from shipping and we're like, yeah, we're now rushing this feature, so it's not going to be good. So let's put it on hold until post 1.0.
All right. So, you're evaluating on a bunch of different criteria, it sounds like, you know, one being, okay, is this an absolute must-have or is this a nice-to-have? It sounds like you're also evaluating on, yes, we want this feature, but there's no way we, just with the time and the resources and people we have, we can get it done and
right.
be satisfied with the quality of it. I'm assuming that that's always in the back of your mind too. Is like, how could we rush this feature and get it in, or and it would be okay and not great? Hey, yeah, let's. I just know your guys' reputation. It seems like anything you put in your products, you really want to make sure the experience is great, which is something as a consumer I appreciate.
Thanks. Yeah, very true. We had we even had some testers because we had opened up for kind of a public. It was public private beta mm-hmm. Where we did a call and then people had to kind of tell us some things. But the point is we had a bunch of people. We had like at least 3 or 4. That to me is a bunch, considering the size of the group. That were saying, wow, for a 1.0, this is so much. Like, I wouldn't have, like, I think we probably do go a little overboard for our 1.0, mm-hmm. but I think, again, we want to solve a problem, right? So for us, we don't see it as overboard. We see it as this is the app that has to be our 1.0, or otherwise it's not going to be a solution that we would be happy with.
Right.
But yeah, things do get cut, and yes, we do have probably more than average, but I will also throw out there, you know, look, we're an indie developer. It's me and Kent. We do have some contractors and people we work with, like Wolfgang and other programmers. But we're still a small team. I mean, we're only a few guys. We're a few people. But the point is that being indie and having our own company also affords us the ability to make decisions quickly and change quickly. So, you know, in many big companies, they'll have these features and they have to have them in because they've been sort of deemed necessary. And then the features are sort of half-baked because the app has to ship, right?
Right.
We can make the decision to cut a feature because we don't care. We know it'll come later. And honestly, we're not putting our profits over our products. That's what I mentioned to you earlier. No matter how successful we've gotten, and I think you've seen this with CardHop now because you know Fantastic how successful, we're not looking to ship an app for the sake of shipping an app to make money. We want to ship an app that's really good. So we can make these decisions at the last minute and say, oh, we're cutting this because you know what? It's not going to be that good. And we can ship without it. It'll come later. And you know what? The world's not going to stop if the feature comes in 3 to 6 months
sure.
or even a year, even 2 years, whatever.
So two last questions, then we'll talk a little bit of CardHop and probably get out of here. One being, so now, you know, you've gone through this whole process. You're in development. You're getting ready to go. How do you figure out, you know, when to ship, I guess is the question, right? And or maybe delay shipping and you know, that.
I don't know that I can answer this question.
Right. It's a tough one. I think it is, but I'm bringing it up because I get this question a lot. You know, there's a lot of developers. It's like, yep. You know, because you have a vision for a product, but at some point you also want to ship something. So I imagine that's a dilemma, right?
It is. I mean, the short version, I guess I would say is, shipping also comes for us, again, as indie developers. We don't have shareholders and we don't have deadlines, right? So we can kind of,
that's
really
what
important.
I was getting at, you know,
yeah.
you could potentially postpone indefinitely, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's what I'm getting. And it's like, where do you go? You know what? We just got to ship this thing. Like, is there a point that you in projects that you found you usually reach that? Or is it just like, no, we're going to keep going on this until we deem it's ready.
No. So one thing, and this is definitely my job in the sense of I have to decide, right? So like the product's my vision, obviously the execution is my vision, and then the shipment is my vision. So there's a point, I mean, I'll be straight up, the whole 5-year cycle that we had with this was killing me. If you talk to lots of my friends, like, you know, once 2 or 3 years, I'm like, if this thing doesn't ship this year, I'm killing it, right? Like,
right.
It drives me nuts.
Because, yeah.
Yeah, I want to ship it. I want to get it out, you know?
But how do you resolve that? Because you go, okay, it's been 3 years, we're going to ship it this year. And then you realize that, no, we're not, you know, I know that's draining, but from a business standpoint, you know, what's that feel like, I guess, is what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, okay. So that's a perfect question, because the reason how I could, I guess, square it up is that we were focusing on Fantastical. We made conscious decisions that we'd get like 2 steps forward on CardHop and then be like, oh, well, you know, now iOS 7 came out. So we had already been working on Fantastical 2, and like priorities changed due to Apple, right?
Sure.
New OSs, new products, new whatever. So I will say that CardHop got delayed, or we'll call it rescheduled, because of important things with Fantastical. And when you have a successful product, it's obviously easy to say, hey, we're going to focus on that, because that does sustain our lifestyle and our business, which that is also important. You know, I said earlier, we don't make apps to make money, but you have to make sure you're making enough money to pay your people and keep the stuff going, right? There's right. certainly costs in this. I have to make money for myself, right? So the app has to obviously be some level of success. So Fantastical was a very good, I guess I'll call it an excuse to delay CardHop. In other words, I could justify it by saying, yeah, I mean, we really do have to put our efforts here. Okay, CardHop's delayed again. And then, you know, eventually it did become so, I mean, last year was so painful that we hadn't shipped it.
Right.
But I think what happened last year was I knew it was getting so close that I was like, okay, this, you know, 2017 has to be the year. And then to answer your question of how we finally did it was, we didn't want to ship it necessarily before WWDC because Apple announces a bunch of new stuff.
Sure.
But believe it or not, we said, you know what? No. Why does it matter? Let's get it out. And then around the time that we were originally looking, which was earlier in the year, we had some concerns about a couple features, and we said, you know what, let's just see how it goes. But one way or the other, we're shipping it this year, even if it's December.
Right.
And once WWDC,
so you drew a line in the sand. At some point you're going to draw a line in the sand.
We definitely did. Cause we were going to ship it earlier in the year. And when we had this challenge, we said, okay, you know what, let's give it a little more time. Cause there really is no rush at this point. I mean, we want it out, but there's no specific deadline, right? If it doesn't ship by the end of this year, like that's it. Like we're shipping, like we set this, the line that we were shipping it. But then anyway, WWDC came, we hadn't seen anything new or major. We had solved the problem that we were looking to solve, which by the way, was a massive UI problem, which I can tell you about, but believe it or not, solving that problem, and it's kind of ironic that it was at the end, solving that problem made the app entirely different. And I believe is part of its success.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So I said there was one other thing, and the risk of this ending up being a long conversation, but I think, again, it's another really important thing, especially in the sort of economic dynamic that is set up around Apple and their products, and you probably know where this is going, is how do you figure out how you're going to sell and price this thing in the world of in-app purchases and freemiums and just straight-up pricing and all that sort of stuff. I ask because this, I think, is a huge challenge for new developers when they're looking at trying to figure this stuff out. It's because there are so many options from, you know, ads and all these other things. So how does that conversation go down, and how do you figure out that?
Pricing is absolutely, I would say, the most trickiest part of my job, because everyone is going to be unhappy, right?
Right. Yeah.
We have people that complain that it's too cheap. we actually have a bunch of users that are like, oh my God, why are you making this so cheap? You know, don't sell out to the people who want cheap apps. Like, seriously, it's crazy.
I'm a little bit in that camp sometimes with certain products, you know, I'll admit.
Yeah, no. I get it myself. I mean, so to be clear, we don't think $14.99, well, it's a launch sale of $14.99, right? It's going to go up to $20. So we'll just call it $20. We don't think $20 is cheap because we're users as well. And we try to say, what would we pay? Now, it's a menu bar app, not a full app. Although I would argue, I don't think that matters sometimes, because as long as it provides functionality, why does that matter, right? You're paying money for pixels. That's weird, right?
I wouldn't call it, I mean.
But there is a perception. There is a perception that it's a lighter weight app, right?
Well, yeah, maybe.
I'm just saying they're like,
I get the emotional perception. I agree.
Exactly. I'm not saying I agree, but I get it. Right. And I think this is why, again, I'm good at pricing, as well as I try to at least put my feet in the other shoes of people. I can see it. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I see it. So then we start going from, okay, well, you know, what would we pay? We probably would pay $30 to $50. You know, it's in a real optimal world in our mind, in our brains. I've asked Kent, I've asked friends, I think 30 to 50, but 30 to 50 is where people go, oh, but I think about it. Like, I'd have to try it out and really need it. Right. So, okay. People would pay 30 to 50, but that doesn't mean they'd buy it. It means that's what they would pay if they needed it.
So well, then now we start saying, you have to prove, right? You have to prove to them that it's something they need.
Exactly. Now we do think the app is good, but now all of a sudden we have to really prove value for that price. So then we start saying, okay, well, what's the lowest we'd sell it? Now, we kind of came up in the middle because we did have discussions of selling it for 10, never below 10. I just think at that point it's bad. I think you're just, especially for a Mac app, you're just massively devaluating it. But we feel like 20, that's why I said, you know, 10 was kind of the low, and 30 to 40, maybe 50 is the high. 50 would be pushing it though. But the point is that I think 20 is a really fair price. It's not cheap, so to speak, right? It's a $20 bill, so I wouldn't call that cheap, right? No one's just throwing away $20 bills. Although if anyone's throwing away dollar bills, I'll take them. but if you have a $20 app, I think it makes the decision to buy it a lot easier if you even like it a little.
Right. Well, and at least on the Mac side, you still have the option to allow a trial, right? Which helps. As opposed to if this was an iOS app, you know, that brings up a whole, I imagine, different set
of
challenges you're talking about pricing.
Exactly. As an iPhone app, I mean, you know, $10 for an iPhone app is expensive, right? So,
I don't think so. But yes, the market has come to bear on that. And that's why I'm bringing this topic up, right, a person who's developing apps, because this is the part of the conversation that I'm concerned about. Is I like indie developers. I like guys like you who are making amazing, great stuff. And I want you guys to stick around and be able to continue to create amazing, great stuff. And when the price points get pushed to, I have to sell this for 99 cents or $2.99, even though the value of it is, you know, 10 times that, that's painful.
No, thank you. I appreciate it. And you're right. I will say, not to knock lower prices, because there was a lot of, how should I say this? There were a lot of lessons that came out of even the 99 cent apps. And those lessons are, is that someone off the street who isn't really into computers, that's just sort of an average Joe, they would never even think to buy a computer program. Like, that's just not in their mind. But they see something, they're like, oh, that's a buck, I'll try it, right? So there is something to be said about opening up an audience to something by making the price attractive, right? It's just like music. You could buy a single for a dollar when you couldn't previously. Remember when we used to have to buy like cassette singles or record singles? And they were expensive, right? And then remember, you'd have the hit. So you'd be like, I only want the hit. I don't want to buy the album. But then the cassette single was pretty expensive. So then sometimes you're like, oh, I'll buy the album, right? Whatever.
Right.
I do think, I'm not saying I would ever do a 99 cent app, although I'll never say never, because if it has the right purpose and it's a small little thing and I really want everyone to buy it, I would do that. But you have to balance the audience that you're pitching to with the price that you believe is fair, and off you go. In fact, we aren't getting many price complaints on CardHop. So a lesson I'll also convey to you is, have you ever heard, if you don't get any complaints, you probably priced it too low?
Yep.
Yeah. So the good news, I guess it's good. The good news is we didn't price it too high. And I believe 15 or 20, you know, normal price is a fair price.
Right.
So we're not offending people, which we certainly don't want to do. It means we've created a welcoming and inviting price, which hopefully means we actually get more people buying CardHop than would have, right? In other words, it's almost like an experimental price for people. I'll try it. I'll buy it, right?
You have reputation too, I think.
That's true. That's true. But believe it or not, the reputation only gets you so far, because if you look at how many millions and millions of Mac users there are.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a big market out there. But my point is just that, you know, I like to err on the side of lower pricing, which is kind of ironic because with like Fantastical 2 for Mac, that app's $50. And we erred on the lower side. We actually were thinking about doing 80 or 60 or anywhere between 60 and 80, right? Mm-hmm. We don't get tons of complaints. So again, we probably priced it too low, but that one we do get a lot of complaints on. Where people are like, oh, I can't believe this is 50. I'd buy it at 20 or 30. Here's the thing. That app, Fantastical 2, we know how much stuff we've built into that. We know how far it's come and how much professional, you know, how many professional features there are. That's absolutely worth $50. And if you don't think it is, then we're not the app for you.
Right.
That's fine.
Well, I think that last statement, too, is another good one for developers to kind of wrap their head around, too. Is, you know, if you've built the quality and the value in the app and you've gone through this thought process that you've sort of just described and decided and landed on a price, I would argue, you know, don't compromise on that. You know, resolve yourself to be okay that there's going to be a certain segment of the market that maybe you're not marketing to, right? They're not your target audience. And I think a lot of developers kind of forget that in chasing like sales numbers. You know, like volume they put volume ahead of that sometimes. And I don't know that that's all necessarily the right thing to be doing.
No, it's not. And I think you're right. So, but also I'll give another tip. I don't know, what am I up to, like 4 or 5 now? But like the tip is also, if you make a pricing problem, you can always change your price. I've actually, you know, I work besides Flexibits, I work with other companies, I advise them. And then of course I get a lot of people asking me for input.
Right.
And I always love helping people. And because of all the people I've helped, I've obviously got a lot of data, which allows me to make better decisions. But the point is, I've seen certain people, friends of mine who are developers, are like, oh, I priced it here and I don't know what to do. Change the price. Like they almost think like once you set a price of $20 and it's a flop, you can't go down. Or if you charge 30 and you're selling so many and you're like, you can change your price. It's not advised to change it a lot. You know, I'm sure you've seen these people experiment with prices where it's 5 and then 20 and then 30 and then 1. And it's like, come on. Right.
Right.
But
yeah, just throwing darts at the wall.
Yeah. I'm not saying do, you know, price engine optimization, right? Whatever. But there's nothing wrong with, once you have enough data and you think something isn't working, to just make a tweak to your price, right?
Sure. Sure. Supply and demand. I mean, it's funny because a lot of this is classic, you know, business 101, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, look, we're called Flexibits, and it's kind of funny. I named the company that because flexible bits. We like to be flexible. But I do think flexibility is the thing that me and my business partner and my team have, in that we want the best experiences and we're not bound to something. If customers are upset about a price, we're probably going to change it. If you know what I mean? Like, right. I just feel like sometimes developers, and I know this because I'm a developer too, I'm not an engineer specifically, but I have an engineering mind of understanding how this all works. Engineers sometimes get set in a way, like they see a pattern or they see a direction and they're like, oh, this is it. And then if it doesn't work, they're like, oh, it's got to work. I knew it. Right. Like, and they kind of make excuses. And I think sometimes it's okay to just say, this isn't working. Let's change the course. So I guess that would be tip number 5 or 6 is, if you see something not working, again, give it enough time. That's another problem I've seen people do, is they don't have instant success in a week and they're like, oh, it's a flop.
Right. Well, that's a little bit of our world now, right? Everything is instant gratification and instant this and that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But you do need data, because look, if I give you 3 days of my sales, you may look at those 3 days and say, oh, what a flop. And maybe that's 3 days during a off week or when it was vacation and people weren't buying productivity, whatever, what have you, right?
Right.
So you have to look at a big amount of data. You have to look at least a month or whatever it is. My point is don't just make decisions after a very short period of time, because just the way, if you're an engineer and you've created an app with a lot of data and a lot of experience, why are you reacting so quickly to some, you know, market response? Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So try to realize that the market and people and your customers are not bits in a computer. They're real people with real emotions. And you have to realize that now this is going to require not a decision based on logic, but a decision based on data, reason, and experience.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you for sharing your insights. This is really, really great. I do want to give you a chance to talk a little bit more about CardHop. I know we kind of gave the overview of what it is. Is there some other stuff you want to let people know about the app and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, the short, there's not too much to say about it. And it's funny, my apps, I there's not really much to say except we've created a contacts app that's much different than's ever been created before. It's a different approach. It's not just a typical database kind of look at all these contacts and figure out what to do and get overwhelmed by all these lists. In fact, remember I mentioned earlier there was a design detail towards the end that we solved that was a big impact?
Yep.
I'll tell you what it is right now because it's such a big impact. I think it'll make you really realize how good CardHop is or at least how different it is. So throughout the beta for all these years, Adam, we had a regular list like every other app. We had your A to Z. The window just showed all of your contacts.
Right.
And we were fine with that, right? Like that's the app we designed and we were like, this is good, right? Well, at some point, and this was when we decided to delay it a little bit more this year. And again, we're glad we did because it changed a massive, massive function of the app. We decided to hide that list, that all contacts list or any of the lists behind a button. And I'm sure you've seen the app by now. You know, it says like show all contacts, right?
Right.
That button is hiding your list. If you want to see it, you click it and there it is. But the point is we're showing you at the top birthdays and recents. And we feel that every time you open an app, like a contacts app, if you're always looking at some list of people, and let's say it's even the same list, it's kind of burning into your head and you're seeing data that isn't relevant to you. If I see, you know, let's say I'm alphabetizing by name and I see Adam Christensen and Adam this and Adam that, and I'm just, every time I open a contacts app, I'm seeing this information that's the same boring, again, repetitive, burning your brain information. It's almost a turnoff, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to look at the same sheet of paper over and over again, do you?
Right.
So we had this idea, and once we had it, it was amazing because it was like, all right, this is it. Hide the contacts and put information that's dynamic and relevant, aka birthdays, upcoming birthdays, and recent contacts that you've interacted with. And hiding that database, hiding that list of contacts, and allowing the parser to handle it all, I think really is where the magic of CardHop lies beyond the parsing field. So I feel like our parser, which lets you add, edit, search, and interact, like I said, is you know, really the cake. That's the main thing. But well, I guess it's the meat, not the cake, right?
Right. Right.
But it's the meat and the cake. No, the meat is the parsing engine, and the cake is the fact that you don't ever look at your contacts. Now, if you want to open that list and you want to manage them or you want to kind of sort through them or browse them, of course you're free to. But we think the old way of doing things, which is to just make a contacts app that's a big database,
right,
is very, very inefficient and also negative.
Yeah, it's the testament I can give it is, you know, you gave me a copy of this just less than a week ago now, probably just a few days ago.
Sure.
And I am already integrating it. You know, there's a slight learning process because I'm used to doing things the old way. And just like it was with Fantastical, I kind of have to like retrain my brain to use this, but I'm already using the hotkey more and it's already just in the few short, that little short time benefited me. And I love this concept that of the recents, because that's really who I'm interacting with on a daily basis. So if I'm, you know, working on some development stuff, but hey, I need to reach out to my client to contact them now, just being able to hit the hotkey and instantly, boom, they're right there, all their contact information. I can hit the phone icon or FaceTime or whatever it might be and initiate that interaction without sort of breaking stride.
Yeah, no, that's the magic of it, right?
Because before I've got to kind of change gears, I've got to open up another app, I've got to like go, you know, whatever it might be. And it seems like such a small thing, but in practice, it's sort of game changing, if that makes sense. Now, yeah, you sure, know I'll this. I mean, I'm probably telling you stuff you already know, but I want listeners to kind of understand.
No, I want the feedback, because the truth is, look, I make an app for me and I think it's a great app. But if I hear it from you, it validates that I'm doing the right thing. So the next time I could do more right things, right? So no. This is very good to hear. Thank you.
And the other funny thing is, I didn't realize my contacts list was kind of broken, and it's not, right? Because it's still that data repository. The problem is like the view into that repository was difficult and challenging.
Exactly. Right? And that's why we hit it. That's why we hit it, is because why do you want to look at that list? Let the input field do the work for you.
Right.
Just so you know, another quick thing I wanted to throw out there. You were saying, you know, how you like birthdays and the recents and looking at all that. The other thing with CardHop we noticed, which is very different from Fantastical, Adam, is that with Fantastical, when that came out at the time, even with beta tests, people were just like, oh, this is great, I got to use this, right? Whatever. Like, people adapted to it very quickly. I noticed with contacts, people were very almost resistant to even try CardHop. We had a lot of testers that were like, yeah, I don't really use my contacts, or yeah, no, I'm not really interested. And this was actually, this will be another lesson. this is like a good marketing moment that we learned, that the problem of contacts is so bad, right? It's such a bad experience, such a bad tool set, and such a bad like thing, that people don't even want to try it. People, even if you say, hey, here's this better thing, they're like, yeah, I don't really use contacts, I'm not interested. And the truth is, and you know this, how many times do you interact with people daily, be it an email or a phone call or an instant message or an iMessage or a FaceTime call or a Skype, whatever it is, how many times do you actually interact with your contacts daily? Lots, right?
Yeah, a ton. That's just a thing. But and at the same time, not really, right? Because it's a painful process.
Absolutely. So getting people saying, I'm not really interested, or I don't think this is for me, it was very hard for me to process this and resolve it, because I'm like, but that's what this is meant for, right? This is meant for you to like, you're saying you don't use contact. Like, anyway, so the point is that I had seen a couple even reviews or posts that came out when we launched, and they still even had this idea where it was like, oh, you know, we know people that do calls or do this or do that, but I'm not sure it's for them. So the point I'm making here is this segment, this contact segment, is such a bad experience that even when you show someone a tool that says, hey, here's a better way to interact with your contacts, people go, oh, well, I do it all these other ways, so I don't think this is for me.
Right.
It's like old habits die hard. And I think as an app developer and designer, you have to understand, especially if you're making a productivity app, you're trying to change people's old bad habits. And most people don't like to change. Old habits die hard, right? So I find it very interesting with CardHop that there's people who have dismissed it or sort of said, oh, it's not for me, when it exactly solves the problem that they're doing, but they say, oh, I'm already doing it this other way, I don't need this. Very interesting. Very interesting.
Right. Well, I have already seen that you're getting a lot of great buzz on this. It's obviously a great app. I'm loving it so far. And I, again, just want to say thank you for coming on and sharing kind of your insights on, you know, app development and creating these great products and stuff like that. And also just for making great apps. So thanks for hanging out for a little bit and chatting with us.
Yeah, no worries. You know, I've been a fan of yours a long time and a listener, and also, I guess, guest of the show for a long time. So I always appreciate being, I appreciate being able to share with you. It's great.
Actually just used CardHop to find out that I still had your cultured code contact info in my card for you. Well, now, so I just fixed that. So
I was going to say, now you have to use CardHop to update that, right?
I did. I just did as we were chatting.
Did it work as expected, I hope?
It did.
All right, good answer. Cool. But yeah, it's really cool to talk with you. And, you know, every time we do something new, it's kind of the questions I've noticed get even a little bit different over time. It's fun because I do not only like making apps, I like making productivity apps because, again, I really like helping people and sharing my knowledge. So this is a great app. I'm really appreciative that you invited me on.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. And just so everybody knows, Flexibits is the website. CardHop is the new product. You can find it on the App Store now. And buy it now if you're interested, because like you said, you do have the introductory pricing. So,
yeah, the sale is for a limited time. We will end that. We're not sure of the date, but it'll be pretty soon. I mean, we don't want to have a sale forever. And just because I always like to say this, it's flexibits.com, FlexiBits.com.
Great.
Just to always clarify, because everyone seems to want to type Flexibits.
Got it. All right. Thanks, Michael.
All good. You're welcome, Adam. Thank you.
There you go. Michael Simmons from Flexibits. Check out Card Hop. It is available now. You can go purchase it and grab it while it's on the discounted price. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile. Check out PDF Pen, new version 3 for iOS, and also PDF Pen for Mac, PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can also check out their other great software and applications by going to smilesoftware.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media, and they are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome your feedback. You can send emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.